on sale up there. His new book, Lead It to Me, a Book of Stories, was published this summer by University of Nebraska Press. Publishers Weekly has said the constant threat or fact of violence in these stories, combined with Jones' idiosyncratic staccato prose, makes for gripping and visceral reading. Author Gerald Visner calls Jones a visionary storier who has created fantastic narratives. And author Sherman Alexie says Stephen Jones writes with a whole new aesthetic and moral sense. He doesn't sound like any of the rest of us, and I love that. Stephen teaches here in the English department at Texas Tech, where he teaches creative writing and literature, and he plays a mean game of basketball. The stories in Bleed It to Me are far as guns and the distances required to make proper use of either. These are the distances that yield no echo, too wide or flat or nondescript, leaving you waiting and waiting to hear back from yourself in however diminished a form, telling you who you are and maybe, if you're lucky, who you're supposed to be. The characters in these stories are left to figure that out on their own. There are kids trying to be adults and adults trying to be parents. Criminals are just plain screw-ups trying to keep out of jail. Indians trying to be, well, what exactly? The Lone Ranger and Tonto may be fist-fighting in heaven, but here on Earth, things aren't so simple. Down here, it's wilder than the West never was, and Stephen Jones has given us a map. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Jones.
It's a dress-up night, so I wore my dress-up watch. It's really fancy, but it's so fancy it won't tell you what time it is unless you push a button. Then all these lights light up and this code. So if y'all see me doing this for a while, it's because I'm waiting. Just doing all this whole trick and I don't know what time it is. But hopefully I won't do that too much. I don't dress up too much either, which is good. So I usually know what time it is. It's always scary doing readings. I always tell myself if I quit being scared, then it's time to quit. But then I get up here and do it, and I just wish I wasn't scared, you know? The thing you're most scared about, though, is that nobody's going to show up. Thank you all very much for coming tonight. A lot of people are here. But I've had it happen where nobody showed up. I was at a book of people down in Austin reading once. My very first novel, nobody knew my name, and especially nobody knew the novel. And I show up. Book People's a pretty good venue. And nobody was there, and they said, well, maybe they got the time drawn. So I waited 30 more minutes, and nobody was still there. And then pretty soon, I hear the manager on the PA. He's trying to whisper, but it's hard to whisper on the PA. And he's saying, everybody in the break room, go to Stephen Jones' reading. And you're supposed to be able to pull a pretty good crowd in your hometown, but my hometown is Midland, just south of here, and my last novel published, I think it was my last one, and my publicist booked me there in spite of my misgiving. I kept telling her, don't bring me to Midland, don't bring me to Midland, but she insisted, and so I did it. And sure enough, I show up, and it's my grandma and my aunt, and there was one guy sleeping in a chair, and he was kind of in the crowd, but I don't think he got a lot from the reading. And then sure enough, so many of my family is from Midland that people started walking through there in my family. They're just there hanging out, you know. My Uncle Henry came through, and he was limping, and I asked him, what's up with that limp? And the day before, he got snake bit by a rattlesnake, and he said he went to the hospital, laid in bed for 2 hours, and then he was back in the field by 5 o'clock, so he didn't let it get to him. And I also had it happen. I had it happen up here once. I was doing a reading at a bookstore here in town. And there were some people there. We're having a good time. Or I was having a good time. I don't know what the audience was doing. And sure enough, a kind of distant relative comes wandering through, and I see him, and I think, oh, he's here late, you know? But then he didn't know I was reading at all, and he doesn't understand what a reading is, so he kind of dodges up the podium and starts talking to me. It's quite awkward. I know the flyer said I was going to read from Bleed It to Me, and I will read from it, but when I first came to graduate school, when I was still a lot more impressionable than I am now, I guess, I was at North Texas, and they have these basement offices where the TAs are kind of housed, I guess you could call it, or poisoned with asbestos, however you want to term it. And I was down there, and there was this guy who I thought this is the smartest guy in the world. I came to learn that he just talked a whole lot, but at the time, I still thought he was pretty smart. I could hear him over the top of the wall saying about a fiction reading we'd all just been to that it had been a crap reading because the author just read stuff that was in the book. The reason for fiction readings is that you should hear new stuff. The writer should be trying out new stuff on the audience. And so even though the guy wasn't that terribly smart, I still like to try out new stuff on the audience. I feel dishonest if I don't. So here's something. This is coming out in a journal called WordWrite, an online journal. And this is my first, I guess the flyer also says it's a fiction reading. This is actually my first step ever in nonfiction. And I didn't mean to write nonfiction. I wanted to write a piece that there wasn't any lies in. I thought maybe that would be nonfiction. I don't know what it would be, really. It's coming out as flash fiction, which I prefer because there's probably still some statutes in place or something. So I'm quite happy that people will read it. It's too real. And it's quite possible that I compressed a couple of events. I can't swear to the sequence, but all the facts, as I can remember them right here. It's called Bestiary. I grew up in a land shaped by animals. The first bird I shot in a buffalo wallow. There would be countless more. Owls and ducks flying away with my pellet gun pellets lodged in them. Doves I wouldn't learn to clean and eat for years, the blood on their yellow breasts like a dab of jelly on butter toast. Quail that were beautiful and pliant in my hand. Scissor tails that fell in looping arcs, their tails disappointing up close. Mounds of red and white and black woodpeckers, my grandmother would point out for me, that, even with their bodies full of birdshot, still need to be chased down in the tall grass. Once, on accident, a mockingbird that wanted to put me in jail, take away my gun. The hole I dug to hide it in was deep. There would be more. A bull bat, just to see if I could. A compact little hawk of a kind I've never seen again. I buried it too, then took three steps away. Found a pair of rattlesnakes mating, and watched them until they saw me and tried to break apart. Couldn't. Hours later, skinless, headless, no guts, they still rose from the pan of grease I was cooking them in, struck at me with their blunt necks. Another time I walked onto a pair of sand rattlers, never knew how purple and pink their belly skin was until they were dead. That same year, a normal rattler pulled at my pants leg but couldn't get through. I killed it for so long that the venom got in my arm, swelled it from wrist to elbow. Days after that, just to see if it was a thing I could do, or to see if it was something I shouldn't do, maybe, I got down on my knees before a rattler and we stared at each other for half an hour until it started striking. And I started trying to tap it on the head with my ball peen hammer. I buried it in a deep, deep hole with an owl I killed that same day. Then, to keep them there, upended a 55-gallon drum, drove it down around the owl and the snake until it was level with the ground, told myself it was over. Now, me, them. That I was sorry and it was over. I was wrong. Later that year, I would stand in the brake lights of a pickup truck and help beat rabbit's heads against the bumper, because they weren't dead enough yet, then throw them into the pile already spilling over the bed rails. Because it was summer and we couldn't eat the rabbits, had to throw them into a pit for the coyotes. Later, in the snow, with slide-action rifles that felt so much like the air pumps on my pellet guns, I would run down elk and mule deer and whitetail from the dancing beds of trucks, shoot prairie dogs to sight my gun in. I looked through my scope one afternoon at what should have been a cow moose 30 yards out, broadside, but instead stood into a cinnamon grizzly, her two cubs tumbling into view. That time, my uncle guided the barrel of my gun down for me and kept it there, and I looked over the top of my scope at the mother bear and wondered where my uncle had been 3 years ago in my buffalo wallow, when, out of birds but not daylight, I'd aimed for too long straight up into a power line and hit it, then felt a small slug immediately in the ground on my left foot instead of the bones of my face. I dug the slug out. It was shaped like a mushroom, still hugging the power line, and I did any of a thousand things with it then, I suppose. None of them right. I wrote a part two to that about all the dogs I've had that have met really unfortunate ends. It was a sad, sad piece. I don't think I can read it again myself. Here's a little thing I wrote. My hometown, which I know is a Springsteen title, and it kind of reminds me of the John Cougar song too, I guess. The security guard carries a white balloon on his nightly rounds. You can sit on top of the gazebo just north of the town square and see him moving through the zoo. Nobody knows if it's the same balloon each night or a different one. White is the least common color, though. Down the spine of a beer bottle, where the paper label overlaps itself, the balloon looks like the pale crown of a tall bald man stopping at each of the cages to peer over the top at the animal within, perhaps retracing one good childhood outing. as far as we know, too, there's been no helium on the zoo grounds since a hyena accident, so we have to assume the security guard is a smoker, filling the balloon with his heated breath. Maybe it lasts just long enough for him to make his rounds, or maybe he stops at the crocodile pool, pulling out a cigarette under her lidless gaze, then blowing into the sphincter of his balloon the way you blow it to your fighting cock, which is with your eyes closed in prayer. Our children are too young to be seduced by him either, the security guard. On any given Halloween, each street will have at least one police uniform adapted for zoo use, balloon in tow. Some of the older kids, lanky and pale, even pretend to be the tall, bald man the balloon almost is, but we discourage this. Wherever they smoked cigarettes and took the beer we leave on the seats of our cars for them, when we go hand in hand over up the gazebo's rain gutter. As far back as anyone can remember, too, no one's ever broken into the zoo. Not us, or the class before us who did it all, or the class before them. The one night of every year, the walls of the zoo are supposed to swell out to the city limit signs, and then comes a man with a balloon, shining his flashlight into each of our windows, into each of our faces, our dull eyes, before moving on, leaving us to our eating and mating and pacing. Some of our houses are 1,456 feet square, and some are 1,822, and we know each of those feet so well. That was written at a time when my main objective in writing stories was to get a hyena in every story I wrote. Do you want to see that hyena? You don't always write stories for all purposes, I think. Here's something that's brand new. It's neat that Matt introduced me because I just finished writing this and Matt wrote asking me something to borrow money from. I sent this back to him, just cut and pasted it back. And it's really short. It's, 300 words, maybe. It's now a 10 or 11,000 word story. He swings it by the neck. He was 6'1", with about 2 feet of nylon rope stretching up behind his head to the crossbar. I didn't see it, but I heard about it enough to know he was between the baby swing at the end and the swing beside it. One of the normal ones with the ground scooped out hard underneath. Standing between those two swings the next summer, after a school year without a swing at all, when the teachers thought I was made of glass, when my brother was supposed to still be on the seesaw, or the merry-go-round, or up in the rocket, watching us all through the bars, I wondered not why he had done it, but how. Did he stand in the basket of the baby swing, balance himself with one hand on the chain, reach up for the crossbar, or had he just jumped flat-footed up there, the rope already around his neck, and then hung with one veiny arm, his other hand tying? The second, I thought. Because I'd seen him jump, latch onto the rim over our driveway. Because I'd seen him lash boats and tires and coolers to the pier without even having to look down from whatever girl was walking by. But I didn't swing, just stood there. Not because I thought the stories were true. David, dead, wouldn't waste his time lying in the playground, not with the lingerie wholesaler just down on the interstate. The reason I didn't swing was because the crossbar was only 6 feet up now, meaning the chains going up from the plastic seats were maybe 4 feet. Even with a lot of make-believe friends to push hard enough that they'd have to run through, dive under, even then, that sweet spot at the top of the arc where the chains go slack like your stomach, it wouldn't last. The swing wasn't fun anymore. David had ruined it. That's some bad stuff, I guess. And I thought, yeah, I am pretty immature, I guess. I don't know. Time to grow up later. And there's another little short piece called Southern Gothic. This is based on high school, anyways. Not that high school was like my glory days or anything. I kind of got kicked out of high school, so. I mean, it was glory days. I was in a lot of pool tournaments, and I did pretty good. But as far as diplomas go, I didn't do all that. My friend and I were driving down some road in Midland, and just going up in the country for who knows why. And there at a convenience store on the side of the road, we saw this really, really tall, bald guy holding up a baby real high. And there was his wife or a girl or some girl was standing, she was short, and she was standing under him jumping, trying to get the baby. And we thought we were heroes, so we stopped to fix the situation. And I don't know what happened after that. But, so I wrote the story, trying to figure out what happened, I guess. Southern Gothic. The way it works down here is simple. My father's 17, no job, no nothing, coasting into a tar paper convenience store on fumes when there's this tall, bald guy holding a baby up, palmed in one hand. The baby's wearing a diaper that soaks up the sun. The man's arm is inky blue with tattoos. The woman trying to climb him has to be the kid's mother. It's the casual way the man smokes his cigarette that gets to my dad. Words are passed, but they don't matter, never do. What does is the cap bar or broom handle or high lift jack or whatever gets used first in the tall guy's gut, then on his bowed back. Then on the base of his slick bald skull, my father holds the child too long, long enough that his truck cocks out, long enough that when the mother takes the snub nose from the bald man's waistband, my father shakes his head no, takes it from her, walks into the store with it by his thigh because he needs gas, he needs chips, bean dip, mustard, he needs everything but to point the gun at the girl behind the register, who doesn't know to tell my dad about the trigger pull, which is in ounces, not pounds. He doesn't mean to shoot. He tells her he's sorry, oh God, but she's spread so thin he doesn't know where to talk anymore, and he has to leave his chips on the formica, just take the gas 9 years down the road with him, into what's becoming night already. His headlights making that center stripe incandescent until it's blotted out by a livestock trailer, its guts spilled all over the sticky asphalt. Horses, blowing steam and pain, ears and forelocks burned off. My father rises from the cab of his truck like the angel of death he thinks he is. And when he doesn't have a sickle, just uses an implement from the bed of his truck, a knife from the knifing rig, the blade 36 inches long. It leaves a line welling in his hand as he walks among the horses, touching each one between the eyes before bringing it down, before bringing them down. Even the mare who gets up and runs from him into the shiny grass, into the fence the same color as the sky. He says something as he opens her throat, but it doesn't matter, because he's already miles and years ahead, and the truck stopped nursing the coffee, the only thing his liver will allow anymore. His hands still shake around the ridge of scar tissue, though, until he thumps some dull change under the table, floats over to the gift bar with other truckers, all the guilt toys there under the glass, lidless, smiling. He paces before the counter, drawing close and then backing away until he buys them all he can carry, and stumbles out the door, trailing fuzzy green flesh, elephants, ostriches, snakes. The waitress picking them up for him. He watches her, waits for her. In a moment of unexpected tenderness, they draw together in the half light, sway with the padded animals at their feet, and pulls it still blanket of the back doors and the cross-country trailer framing them. Her whispering into his neck, nothing about love or chance or me, just something about a job, a construction site where he eventually pulls pension pay. Or one day at lunch, when we've been shoring up the foundation with plywood and 2x4s and rebar, then we'll never have to see the harsh light of day again, he blows a casual blue line of smoke and smiles at a dog winding through the scrap metal and slide towards us, towards our food, her teats dragging a thin line of milk. The first bite my father throws just past our feet, and one of the old-time hardheads who's seen it all twice already nods. He's seen it all twice already nods, but I don't get it yet. Have to wait for the next throw, farther out. Then the next, on the lip of the pit, we'll pour the cement in. Then the next, in the pit. The dog follows. The old-timer laughs, calls for the crusted chute already. It's time, time. But for me, there's something between me and that dog, like I can't quite reach it, like it's under a smudged glass in a truck stop, and my father hasn't given it to me yet, like I want him to, like he should have, like he did years later when I was too old, or not young enough anymore. And even if he thinks the girl he's dancing with is the one he shot 9 years ago, she isn't, can't be. And I'm not that baby the tall man was holding, all the blue snakes on his arm pulling towards me, but still, God, still, maybe. At the construction site, I'm the last one with a crust of bread, and all the hard hats are waiting to induct me, wanting to induct me. And long after I drop the crust into the pit along with everyone else, I won't stand on concrete at the graveyard if I can help it, even when it's my father, wasted away from driving the back roads, looking for overturned stock trailers to redeem himself with. But there is no redemption, nothing he can do. It's like the rabbits we used to put in the cotton trailer with the dog, how they'd run in beautiful, intense circles, faster and faster, until the side of the trailer was ground for them and everything was skewed, smearing by, and their padded feet were just barely wide enough not to slip through the wire. If we were good people, we'd have killed the rabbits, I guess, but then we'd have had to kill the dogs, too. You can't go on like that, not for long, not for more than 2 or 3 generations, anyway. And then you'll see the sorrel horse standing in the wet grass of the bar ditch one night, her skin jumping in folds. And it won't matter what you say to get on her back, but it does, because she's the one that can take you pounding back into it all over again, if you can just catch her. So I guess we did get some dogs dying. This is a quick story. Let me look at my complicated watch here. 7-7, maybe. All right, doing good. Oh, 8-7. We're doing good. This story, I guess the others I've been saying, they're kind of loosely based on fact, so just pretend this one isn't based on fact. I submitted this to a place that I looked at their submission guidelines, and the guidelines said no flashcard fiction. And by flashcard fiction, I took that to mean fiction that was a little bitty, just little flashcards, I guess. And so, of course, I had to send it to them, because it is that. And they published it, which I'm very happy about. Story called Exodus. in 21 parts, I believe, maybe? Yeah, 21. Exodus 1. Annabella, because of her, my mother thinks I'm on drugs. Of course I am, but that's not the issue. The issue is that now she knows. I had to tell her even. It was better than the alternative. 2. Annabella is taller than me by 1 inch. Has hair so dead she doesn't have to use hairspray anymore and actually cares whether I eat or not. Her parents are never home either. Sometimes I picture them after a long day at work, lying side by side in their king-sized bed, hands laced over their lower stomachs, eyes fixed on the ceiling. They can't be comfortable. 3. Crabs. The Romans called them pediculosis pubis. Annabella gave them to me to remember her by. I didn't ask her where she got them. 4. My first sexual encounter with her ended before it began. We were at her house. I was back from the refrigerator, vaulting over her mother's cedar chest at the foot of the bed. The leading blade of the ceiling fan caught me on the bridge of the nose. And for a moment, my body leveled out in the air, legs rising, head falling. And then it was just blood and my face pressed to Annabella's pale stomach, my eyes already swollen shut, both of us trying not to laugh. 5. The day I told my mother I regularly used a wide variety of drugs is the day I call the day of the goat. Because through the thin wall of the bathroom, I hear the news about a goat that had gotten loose downtown, hopping from car to car, up to the occasional diner or cafe to bray. The after-work crowd were running behind the cops who were chasing the goat. It was a mob. My mother was on the other side of the door from me. I fed her names she knew from her pamphlets. Marijuana, crystal meth, ecstasy, yellow jackets. She cried. In the other room, my father leaned forward in his recliner. I could hear it to see the goat better. 6. The day of the goat was also meatloaf night. In the weeks ahead, I would think of the meatloaf we left on the table smothered in ketchup with cross sections of green bell pepper draped across it, and then return to my duties, sneaking every piece of linen and every article of clothing and every scrap of cloth into the washer and boiling them, then using my old t-ball bat to transfer them to the dryer. I don't know what my mother thought was going on. Drug-induced psychosis, paranoia, doing laundry for crack. Every towel in the house was folded down, the curtains reached their sills anymore. 7. You can rent a steam vac with fake identification, too. It's easier than buying beer. My father opened the door on me with it. The carpet lathered, rising. We looked at each other across the living room, and he closed the door, set in his car until I was done. 8. Annabella told me about the crabs over the phone. They were gray unless they'd eaten, then they were reddish brown. Lindane was the cream I needed. Lindane was my friend. I had to get it at the pharmacy myself, though, tucked into the cuff of my winter coat. On the way back, my headlights washed over her house, Annabella's, and there on the curb was her parents' mattress, my nose blood sprayed over it. The crabs were feasting on it. It made the itching worse somehow. 9. The day of the goat, I smelled like medicine, like I had dandruff or arthritis. The scent of meatloaf filled the house. I stood on the back porch and smoked the fattest joint in the history of fat joints. It was more of a cigar, really. I could pick her towels and things while the rest of her fell apart. She said it was so quiet at her house and it was good to hear me talk. I told her they still weren't gone. She told me to use a comb. 10. The vision I had on the way to the table that night was Annabella and me, only flew to South America. I was so hungry. 11. My father cut the meatloaf with a big knife. It was a formal affair. Or maybe I just wasn't to be trusted with sharp objects. Maybe they knew I was stoned. One thing I noticed was that everyone kept one hand under the table while we ate, because they itch. I excused myself to the bathroom, applied the shampoo without water. There was no lather. The bottle said the eggs of pubic lice can live 6 days. It hadn't even been a week then. In the next room, the news wasn't on, but I still knew about the goat somehow, bounding ahead of a teeming mass of police. I smoked the rest of the joint out the open window behind the toilet and then exhaled down the front of my pants once for good measure. The dog was clawing at the door, wanting for me to come out. 12. In the cartoons, all the fox has to do to rid himself of parasites is find the right stick, hold his breath, then jump in the pond. The ticks and lice all gasp for air, climb towards the sunlight, perch on the stick, and then he flings it away professionally, rises lightheaded on the bank, shakes, each droplet of water animated to perfection, arcing off his red body into the sky. 13. On the way back down the stairs, I realized that my mother's T was just another way to pronounce THC. I wanted to tell this to them so bad. 14. At the table, the meatloaf had been done up like a ham, all in slices laying on each other, healthy slices, like it had been dropped into a piano. We ate without talking, and I sang lyrics in my head. My father commented on my apparent thirst, and I commented back on the quality of the tea. My mother looked at him with her look, The Lynn Dane was burning a chemical hole in my jeans. I dropped my napkin 6 times just to adjust, and then set it on my lap, smoothed the wrinkles out like a sheet I was spreading. They were both already watching me. 15. The goat, as it turned out, was a visual aid gone awry from one of the business towers. I felt sorry for it when they got it cornered on the bridge downtown, but then my father went to another station. It could have been an accident, though. Alone in the room, he could force his hand into his pants, his fingernails. His elbow could have just changed channels, and he never even knew. His eyes rolled back to the lights. And for an unusually clear moment, I realized he was terrified that he'd brought them home. I leaned against the tile wall of the shower and smiled. My mother had her face to the space beneath the locked door in the carpet. She was reading the Bible to me. 16. Because my eyes were still swollen, I didn't trust them at first. And because I was stoned, it was all Annabella's fault, too. The joint had been an apology. I'd held it and looked to her, and then she was walking away, the wind trying to blow her stiff hair, having to go around instead. She'd said it could get in your eyebrows, that the higher it is up the hair shaft, the longer you had them. Her hairs were ripe with pale eggs, follicles split end. She was sorry. I smiled, looked at the sky in the best way I knew how, and then stroked the match head on the concrete, slow enough that it didn't catch until the end. The whole time I was watching her. 17. What happened, what I didn't believe at first, was that the crabs were finally leaving at the dinner table. Genesis, Exodus, all that. One of them leading the rest up out of my jeans, out of the oppressive haze of Lynn Dane. He was a hero. The first thing they had to cross, though, was my white napkin. It wasn't a neat single file thing. It was panic. The soccer game was over, the theater on fire. I looked up to my mother and laughed, and the already downturned corners of her mouth turned down some more. Somebody's meatloaf fork clattered to the table. I had no idea what to do with the napkin either, just to run. 18. Weeks later, the house sanitized, all my stashes off property, Lynn Dane still under my fingernails. I saw her again, Annabella, in the fluorescent light at the convenience store at the end of our street. Her father was idling in their car in the parking lot, a newspaper spread between him and the world. I was in line behind her. Her hair was beautiful, healthy, full, lustered, like the commercials say. I touched it, waited, and she straightened her back under her leather jacket, and then the hair shifted. It was a wig. I pulled my hand back, looked at it. This was the day of the hair of the dog. Earlier, I chased our dog down, scrubbed the crabs off him while my father watched, beer in hand. Because I was old enough, he'd been telling me about women you take home and women you don't, or shouldn't. And I told him not to worry, this wasn't going to happen again. He raised his beer to me, father to son. Another successful talk. We never made eye contact. 19. In the convenience store, the clerk was pretending he didn't know what was going on. Then I called my mother from the payphone outside and made up drug after drug for her, then licked them, inhaled them, cooked them up, shot them into my arm, between my toes, and teared up to my right eye because I'm right-handed. The thing was that the dog was white now. Our eye was setter. You're not supposed to apply Lynn Dane in the sun. It says so right on the bottle. Later, I planned a corner and with the wet dry vac, get all the eggs off him because they can live 6 days. What I was buying at the convenience store was a pig's ear, because dogs like them. I hadn't expected Annabella to. 20. Remember me, she said, looking directly into my eyes and passed away. She was buying lip gloss and low salt peanuts. Her boots touched each other, then didn't. She had no eyebrows. My last sexual encounter with her would be on the trampoline in her backyard 3 years later. Stepping out to adjust their motion-sensitive security light, I would break my arm, and her father would have to hold the steering wheel with both hands and drive me to the emergency room. And standing with her in line at the convenience store, I knew all this somehow too, could see it. But my hand was already holding the side of hers. Her dry lips smiled. The Lynn Dane had burned all the hair off her body. I leaned close, closed my eyes, and said into her ear that I wanted whatever she had. It didn't matter. And her hand tightened around mine, and she led me out the door, past her father, across the parking lot, through the remains of my mother's heart. And once out of the light, she leaned on me, removed her boots, her hair, and I did hesitate, yes. But it was only to take a little shot, snapshot before we exploded into the night like birds. 21. Only birds don't know what it's like to really fly, to jump into that perfect space between a downtown bridge and the wide roof of a recreational vehicle heading out of town, and then just float for an impossible second. Your veins shut full of drugs, both imaginary and real, with names like ecstasy and love and gonorrhea and speed and apology and innocence and acid and guilt and music and peanuts and crystal and crank. But there's never any rush like the first time, a fan blade rushing towards your face. Until I caught Annabella's father watching me in the rear view the night of the trampoline. Never knew that either. I'll read something from that. I have a cannibalism story here, but I'm running out of time. My watch is trying to come off, too. I don't wear it, man. I don't have to work yet. It's got those fancy clasps. You know, let me get a double kind of clasps. I had a watershed moment a couple of weeks ago. I love taking road trips, not to go to other places. I don't really care about other places, but there's Whataburgers on the interstates. I love that so much. And for years I've been experimenting, trying to build sweet tea like they build it. And, you know, just putting more and more sugar. And I try to put it in when the tea's boiling. I like different stages. It never tastes the same. It makes me really sad. The other day, a couple weeks ago, I was in Whataburger, and I just got me some normal teas. So I was kind of sad already, it was normal. And I was thinking, man, I should have got a hamburger. So I was just standing there, looking at the menu. And then I started looking at the little condiment area, and there was sweetened on there. And I started looking at the sweetened of the tea, and the drinks and stuff. So I went and bought some sweetened on, and that's the ticket. That's the stuff that Whataburger is. Yeah, I even carry it with me. Really, it's the best thing. Let me see what complicated time it is. Okay. 8:19, maybe two more stories. Yeah. Here's one. Nobody knows this. When I was 12, I used to always go down to my granddad's ranch. He still had his ranch when I was 12. And I wasn't old enough to do any of the work with the hands yet, but he let me hang around the corrals and pretend I was doing something. You know, I get to walk the horses around and do the little stuff that wouldn't get hurt. But the hands, they was impressive. They were so tough. Like, they'd get rattlesnakes in the chutes, and the guys, instead of getting the hoe in there and pulling it out, they'd just crawl in there on their bellies and pull the snake out and kill it. I was in awe, you know. This story comes out of that, pretty much. Nobody knows this. The boy was down for the week because it was supposed to be good for him, working with men, working with horses, being outdoors in the summer. His grandfather told him then to run the gate closed behind them for lunch until his sweat was showing through the back of his leather gloves. The night before, his grandmother had called his grandfather Marcus and told him he was too old for the summer heat. But the old man, Marcus, was spinning his cereal in bite after bite. The boy was 10. He leaned against the wood slats of the corrals with the hired men and ate horses. The horses picked eggs for more. The salt of their sweat was dry on their flanks. The boy's grandfather shied them away with his hat and stood, leaning over the fence, fingers on the ground. The other man said 78, almost a whisper, and the boy's grandfather looked down at him like he'd lost count, and the man closed his eyes under his hat brim. He started to count over, then took his glove off to write it in the notebook he kept in his chest pocket. There were 78. It was almost 1 o'clock. If he was okay, he needed to go home, maybe. And the boy shook his head no. And when his grandfather was turned around for the heifer, still too skittish to come all the way in, too young not to, the hired man who'd horses his back to work. The boy held his eyes like they did, like he was looking hard at a faraway thing. And it was because of that that he missed the one named Rod's horse stepping through the rusted center cap of a mired Model A and into the steel wheel. He heard it, though. Saw the back part of the horse come out of the ground, the pitted rim trailing strands of rubber. The horse put his hand and pulled the trigger, and the hired man who said 78 looked over at the boy for a moment, then over his head to the cattle. They pushed in 110 more that afternoon, found them all bunched up at the water. The heat shimmered above them. The boy ran the gate closed 16 more times and didn't drink from his thermos anymore. At the end of the day, one of the men looped one end of his rope over the neck of Rod's dead horse, the other around his trailer ball, and dragged the horse off so the coyotes wouldn't spook the cattle through the fence that night. Before bed, the boy's grandfather sat at the table and spun cereal into his mouth, and the boy watched him and didn't watch him. He was already calling him Marcus in his head. 4 years later, they were deer hunting, the boy and his father and his grandfather again. It was another thing that was supposed to be good for him, turn him into what his father had been, which was just a stamp of his father, of Marcus. The boy held his gun by his thigh, with one hand like they told him and told him not to. They walked three abreast, the boy in the middle, his father and grandfather flanking him. He could see their flannel through the trees sometimes. His vest was bright orange, the only thing his mother had been able to win that year. He felt like a light bulb, one you screw into the porch socket at Halloween. It was November. On the drive to the lease, his grandfather had stepped in the middle so the boy could get all the gates, standing there holding them while his father and grandfather eased through. Once father had stepped out to show him how to hook the foot of the post back into the wire loop first, then shoulder the top over. The boy had shrugged. He didn't yet know the nature of panic. All he had to do was shoot a deer, then they could get back in the truck and go home. But first they had to even see a deer. Over bologna and mustard lunch, he told his father how his friend did it from a stand, and his father said back to him that Tim probably didn't do it like that. The boy said it was probably good for him. He stood, leaned back into the trees. His father and grandfather followed minutes later. He could hear them clambering through the crusted snow. He held the gun with both hands because it was easier to go uphill that way. He could swing the gun ahead for momentum, something to follow. He tied his point up, up. And when he finally saw the deer, a spike, they stared at each other, breathing hard. The deer not breathing at all. When he raised the gun, he said, the deer swung around, its back legs knocked out from under it, fell, then rose again, and went off. The boy looked at his gun, at the blood misted on the snow, and then stepped after the deer. He was going sideways now, not up, and holding the gun with both hands still, his ears ringing, his heart finally pounding with the deer. And then he pushed out through the trees into a cleared space. It was all stumps, chainsaw ragged. Out in the middle of them, his deer was standing, just like the phone ones in the window of the store. He raised his gun again, then thought better of it, stepped closer, and then up onto a broad stump. Only he wasn't looking at the stump. It was coated with ice. He fell hard, sideways into a smaller stump, and didn't feel so much as hear his leg break high up in the thigh, almost in the hip. He pressed his face through the snow into the wet dirt beneath and kicked his other leg. Didn't start screaming until he saw his grandfather's bundled form break through the trees. He was pushing his white breath before him, his lips set, and he was coming straight for the boy, holding his lever-action rifle loose by his side. The boy was screaming, no, no, and then raising his own gun. Between the two of them was a trail of rich blood left by the deer. Somewhere far off, the boy's father fired his rifle, waiting for an answer. And the boy, 10 years old again, not a horse, gave it to him. It's always my big fear when I'm hunting is, you know, shooting a human instead of a deer. It sounds stupid. I mean, I'm not going to look through my scope and shoot a human. But I think I'm probably not a good hunter because my gun always goes off when I'm just walking around shooting. And whoever I'm hunting with always said, you shoot something? I'll say, yeah, man, I just barely got away. I don't know how it happens. It's been happening my whole life. Guns just go off around here. I'm thinking I should start using a bow and arrow. You know, if they go off, well, they don't go off. Really. I know a guy out in Shallower. He took a deer with a spear. He went to his shop and made a spear of metal. He got the deer that way. Which, it's got to be kind of cool. Maybe. Maybe a tag for it. I mean, look, I don't want to make y'all miss too much of anything. That's really these are the names I know. This is the one story in the collection, which is from a woman's point of view, a woman's voice, a girl's voice. It's a story which, if it has roots, it's... I grew up in my grandmother's house, mostly, and my uncles, who they were in high school then, were always around, just crazy guys. And I still remember I was outside with them so much, and they're always, you know, red-eyed and half-drunk and stuff. They came in with these plastic, or these fiberglass bows once, and we played a game all afternoon, which was we'd stand out in the middle of the pasture and they'd shoot it up in the air, and then the last one to run away lost, and the arrow hit somewhere, anywhere. But none of us died, so it was fun. I think this story probably comes from, and it comes from a lot of things, I guess. It comes from, and I'm sure y'all did this as kids, finding those little featherless birds that fall out of the nest, their babies that you try to keep alive with eyedroppers, you know, and they never live, or you try. Anyways, you can't just step on them because that feels really wrong, too. If you're lucky, a cat gets to them first, but you never have to see them. Yes. This was published as a story called A City in Defense. I might be saying that wrong, S-C-Y-T-H-I-A-N, which some of y'all out there who know history can correct me, I'm sure, but wait till I'm through to wait till the reading's over to correct me. There was somebody named Darius a long time ago, and he was a king or somebody who led armies and stuff. And he went to conquer this one land, and I'm guessing it was Scythia, because it's a city in defense. And the people there didn't have no kind of army to fight him, but So what they did was they just ran ahead of Darius's huge army, and they would leave little things behind him, like in the swamp they left a frog, which told Darius he's gonna have to go underwater to get to him or something. And he left 5 arrows and a bird and something else, and they were like the only people Darius didn't conquer, I think. I could be making this all up, but it felt real when I read it. These are the names I know. A bird. We were 8 and 9 when you found the bird baby dying, dried up in the sun. I told you all about how the mama would never take it back if she smelled us on it. But since you were older, maybe since there were black ants all crawling in the bird baby's mouth already, we took it with us in the pocket of my shirt close to my heart where it could stay warm. And I spit love in its mouth once when you weren't looking, because that's how they eat. 2 days later, when the bird baby was living and dying finally in a shoebox under your bed, we were out looking for bugs to crush in the eyedropper, and I found a spotted eggshell, cut clean in half by maybe a mama bird's beak working from the outside, maybe from a baby bird's working from the inside, maybe together. Either way, you said it was the only one you'd ever seen, and it had to mean something. It had to be more than just a shell. You said it was a sign, finding a bird baby, and then a shell like that. And it meant the bird was ours. Because I was a girl, you wouldn't listen to anything I said. All you could see was you with this bird, how it would look someday. So I quit talking then, just like that, that easy. 14 and a half days, nobody heard me say a word. Not until I had to sit in the office all day, waiting for my mom to get off work to come ask me what was wrong and yell at the principal that I was his fault, but I wasn't like this at home. I never shut up then, always talking. She was lying like always, and when she went out to her car for a cigarette, I told the principal she was a liar, and then I told him some about the baby bird, but not all. Just about how me and you had seen it, and he held his finger to his lips when my mom came back smelling like smoke, and they sat and listened. When I finally ran out of things to say, I started making things up about jobs I would never have and people I would never meet. And somewhere in the middle of it all, I wound up crying through dinner that night, thinking about the bird baby under your bed, the little fingers of a yellow light bulb feeling down through the pencil holes in the box. The sound of you sleeping in the sky above, waiting for everything like it was all going to come to you so right, so perfect. A mouse. One job I never had was at a warehouse full of seed. All the warehouses together went something like 14 acres of covered concrete, no air conditioning, old brick walls that kept it cool even in the summer. Brick walls that had people's names carved into them that went back to 1954, and then some. My name was Ring then, and I was an 18-year-old boy that even the Army didn't want. And the way I carved my sign was by drawing a circle, which was good for a while up there above the phone. At least until Reginald put 2 eyes and a mouth in the middle and made a face out of me. He quit before I could get him back right, but not before he told me once after work that he'd been married years gone by, and had lost his wife to cancer in the bone so deep nobody could get it out. And he was raising his little girl back at his trailer alone now, praying hard every night she wouldn't die the same way, but knowing she would just the same. All he ever ate, too, was potted meat and Vienna wieners from the can. And even though I was always hungry back then, I never did share any of his food like he wanted me to, even though he said he'd let me grow a mustache like a real man. The day before he left is the day I think about the most. Him and me were out in the Warehouse 9, where we kept the better part of our corn, and we were walking around with big soft blocks of camphor, cutting flakes off here and there, and leaving them where we thought they'd best keep the rats out. Sometime, maybe around 6, everybody started leaving. We could hear their trucks and Danny's ready Harley. Me and Reginald were making our way to the dock door, trying to get rid of the last of the camphor in big, obvious chunks. When somebody shut and locked the door, not knowing about us, and we both knew without saying it that we were there for the night. I didn't think it was all that bad, being clocked in 14 more hours. And I just started arranging bags of treated pink corn for a bed of sorts when I heard Reginald beating on the door with a shovel at the other end of the warehouse. And it was then I remembered about his little girl, maybe Audrey was her name. And I helped him, and we tried every door and even broke the skinny glass window out of 2 of them, but it was no good. By the time the sun was all done with leaking in the loose places where the wall went to the ceiling, I couldn't even be around Reginald anymore. I tried, though, for a bit, but every time I said anything to him, he started shaking around his mouth. So finally, I just went back to my corn bed and was lying there burning matches one by one when I saw, half in, half out of one of the bags, a poison dead mouse the size of my thumbnail. Its skin pulled tight around the bones, eyes gone, teeth bigger than I ever saw, bigger than they should have been. And I started shaking then like Reginald, not really for his little girl back at his trailer waiting for him to get home, but for Reginald himself. For how he ate his potted meat off the end of the same popsicle stick every day, and then shut that stick up in foil and put it in the refrigerator to keep the cancer germs out. Tin foil and cold, that was all it took. He never died. A frog. nighttime, and our only child is still never born. We sit together on the couch, opposite ends, me with my books about history, you with yours. Outside, it's the rain dying down finally. Yellow headlights sometimes on the backside of the drapes, sometimes not. This night, while you're asleep on the couch, I'll sit arranging the magnets on the refrigerator until 3. And in the morning, when you wake, you won't be able to read the messages I've left in the plastic-coated symbols trailing up out of blue Louisiana, like Lewis and Clark. I, too, will have forgotten what I meant to say, but the feeling will remain, and I'll be driving Cascades, Sierras. This night, though, now, 3 sets of headlights ago, you lit your last cigarette, and now you've forgotten it. And I start to cry down the back of my face about the things we should be remembering. A bowl in the garage. The smoke gathers around the only lamp in the room and forces the shadows into a tortured dance. The wall is silent. I open the sliding glass door to breathe the after rain air and close my eyes. See the mountain and the road climbing them, going to the same road, like in the paper Montana on the map in the glove compartment somewhere. Close the door, you say, the air, and I see your hand is bound again its cigarette stub. As you breathe in, the ember glows deep under the crusted ash, and I see your face once more, see it all at once, in every way I've known you. As a 12-year-old with hands full of lights and lights and power, as a boy man looking across the bench seat of your father's truck at me, the dome light making you soft and pale, beautiful. As a voice on the other end of the line promising me how good things are, saying it over and over, pleading it into existence. As a sunglassed stranger, standing over an abbreviated plot of hungry earth and rubbing the slacks between your fingers, because you only want to be somewhere else, anywhere else, never try again, here. The beer, the bourbon, the ice falling silently on the green carpet to melt into a world of diaphanous trees. Oh God. I don't close the door. I leave it open and feel you behind me. I leave it open until the frog song comes rolling through the shiny pasture into our childless home. They're praying, I whisper, where you can't hear me unless you try. They're praying, their voices all together in some desperate plea for more and more, wanting only out to drown once and for all in the warm wetness of the pond, that soft second wind where the flies dance higher and higher. Your eyes bore into the smack where I can still feel you. What are you doing, you ask? The frogs, I say. The frogs, you say back. In some places they rain down out of the sky. People have recorded this. You laugh through your nose, but I still don't close the door. Instead, I stand there between two worlds and I wait. 5 arrows. 3 months after you told my dad I was pregnant and he had given us $48 in bottle chains and shown us the door. Silver and copper and telephone poles fused together with words. I was 21 and you were a year older. We were legal. We were running. We were outside Phoenix, Arizona, in the flat of a pasture by some little motel room cabin that we wound up never paying for, even though it was about a week and we were there for 4. It was the closest we came to a honeymoon. My mother had given us a parquet wooden bowl where we separated the dime from the nickels from the lint. The sun went down every day. The last of our gas money had just turned into a red fiberglass bowl in your hands, and we were out in the pasture with a handful of arrows, testing it out against anything that looked worthy. While I was lying down on that blanket we had, trying to talk to you about names, I was saying them all from my book, Abe, Ainge, Alan, Amon, Ash, and then on into the bees. You knew it was going to be a boy. It had to be. We didn't even listen to the girl names. But that was back when you would even talk about it, before we found Seattle in the rain. I was all the way into the L's when you started in talking like you were talking to yourself, and even there, talking to me and a dog, and maybe even another kid after this one, and some neighbors to have cookouts with. And I lay there and listened, and I cried, hearing you say those things because they were so right, so perfect, so like everything I ever did. And you kept, while I quit really listening to what you were saying. 16 years later, though, I can still hear you. I'm still on that blanket with Abe, Ainge, Alan, Amon, Ash, 6 months so long as I'm never gonna die, never. I can still hear you, still see you, still believe you. You're leaning back against the azure sky like a Greek statue, shooting arrows straight up. 3 of them are buried nose first, about 15 out from the edge of my blanket. And you're talking out loud about what kind of car you might want to drive to your work, what kind of work you might want. And you're telling me you'll buy all the watermelon stuff for the kitchen like I've always wanted. And now another arrow is in the air going up, up, and I'm here on the blanket waiting and waiting. And when the arrow disappears, I close my eyes and your voice carries me. Thank you very much.